Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington, D.C. Sierra Leone's President Julius Maada Bio launches the development of the Special Coya Industrial Zone.
It's an economic zone, which means an area is dedicated for industry, 1,600 hectares initially. It is for import substitution.
Nigeria's President-elect Asiwa Jubola Ahmed Tinubu returns home from a trip abroad.
On his arrival, there was a mammoth crowd that waited at the airport to receive him. But there has also been some speculation. He went for medical treatment and has been hiding it.
And Zambia's main opposition group, the Patriotic Front, or PF, says threats to deregister the party is an assault on democracy. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Sierra Leone's President Julius Maada Bio launched the development of the Special Coya Industrial Zone Wednesday. It is a joint venture between the government in Freetown and Arise Integrated Industrial Platforms, an organization that designs, finances, and operates industrial ecosystems across Africa. Officials say the Coya investment project will be constructed on 1,600 hectares of land, and the government has designated as an area for locally manufactured products for exports. The project is expected to be powered by 100 megawatts of solar panels. Local media quotes President Bio as saying, "A stronger manufacturing sector with access to regional and international markets will support foreign currency inflows." He adds that ECOWAS's trade liberalization platform gives the regional body custom-free access to the West African market. For more on the joint venture project between Sierra Leone and the Arise Integrated Industrial Platform, I reached Jasper Ball. He is the managing director of the organization.
Okay, so the whole point of today was the groundbreaking. So we officially start the economic zone of Coya with the construction. So President Bio took the first step. So now it's all happening, and it's an economic zone, which means an area is dedicated for industry, 1,600 hectares initially. It is for import substitution. You know, we have imports in Sierra Leone that are very, very expensive, and it's not necessary. A lot of these things can be produced in the country and can even be exported abroad. So import substitution is the first part, but there's exports as well. There's tremendous potential to export agricultural products, forestry products, and that will be addressed as well. And then it will move on and develop from there.
Now, Jasper, what experience does Arise have in Africa, if I may ask you?
So Arise has started in Gabon in the Special Economic Zone in 2010. And since then, we have developed into Benin, to Togo, and we are building right now in Ivory Coast, Republic of Congo, DRC, Nigeria, Rwanda, and Sierra Leone as well. So it's a track record that spans about 12 years now. And Arise has a very unique model of industrialization where you fully utilize the raw materials that are available locally to transform and export overseas. That's the core of our business.
Talking about the economic zone, how would it look like in Sierra Leone?
So as I mentioned before, it's 1,600 hectares that we're developing here. The first 150 is started right now. So there's going to be big areas for the industry. We're going to have a big dry port, it's called, so a custom bonded port inland that would service all these factories in the zone. We're going to have a power plant, which is right now looks like the natural gas power plant. 100 megawatt is the most realistic. We're looking at solar options as well, but the gas seems most realistic right now. And we're going to have a river port as well that is servicing the waterways. And a lot of warehouses that need to come with that, accommodation, etc.
But do you have any investors interested in this project?
Yes, so we have three investors and a fourth that is in late stage negotiations. So the first unit is going to be a ceramic tiles manufacturer We found all the minerals we need within Sierra Leone to produce direct ceramic tiles, so you don't have to import that. The second is a recycling unit for non-ferrous metals. The third is a pharmaceutical unit. They will do capsules and injectables. Those are the three that are committed now. And the fourth one is an engineering college, actually, that we are in discussion with that see benefit in setting up in this zone.
Now, Jasper, before you go, how about sustainability and the green economy in Sierra Leone?
Yeah, so there's a couple of points that are very important around that. And the first thing is power generation. So we must make sure that our power generation is fully sustainable. That means it's either solar or it's natural gas or it's a combination of those two. That's one thing, and that's a very critical element. The other part is that we are doing a mangrove conservation project on the rivers around the zone that we are just starting now. So conservation and preservation of the mangrove area, that is absolutely critical, and that will ensure that there's enough nature and ground space around the industrial zone.
What do you think are the prospects of this economic zone in Sierra Leone?
There's tremendous prospects in this. I mean, we are talking about probably close to 8,000 direct jobs once the zone is fully built out. That's a lot of jobs. Every single person that's employed indirectly support 3, 4, 5 other people's jobs. So massive impact on Koya, not to mention that when there's sustainable and world-class energy, a lot of other people will come and they will be attracted to the area. So we really see this as something that will power up this local region very quickly. 24 months and you will see a massive change.
Jasper Ball is the Managing Director of Arise Integrated Industrial Platforms. He spoke with me from the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown. Nigeria's president-elect Asiwa Jubola Ahmed Tinubu has returned home from a trip abroad. Addressing his teeming supporters, the president-elect told them to ignore speculation about his health, adding that he is ready to begin working with them. His remarks follow gossip that he was receiving medical treatment abroad. This, while the outcome of the February 25th elections are being challenged by two losing candidates, former Vice President Atiku Abubakar and former Anambra State Governor Peter Obi. Meanwhile, the President-elect and the Vice President-elect Kashim Shettima have moved to the Defense House as they prepare for the official installation scheduled for May 29. For the latest political development, I reach Ibrahim Momo. He is a political analyst based in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
The reaction has been mixed. On his arrival, there was a mammoth crowd that waited at the airport to receive him. But there has also been some speculation. He went for medical treatment and has been hiding it. When he was abroad, there were claims that he was seriously ill. Generally, Nigerians are a bit more happier that he's back. He's in the midst of Nigerians and they are seeing him daily. Because since he came back, he has been receiving hordes of visitors from all walks of life, politicians, the richest man in Africa, amongst others, business elite, and all whatnot have been visiting him. The reason why they have been visiting him, among others, is that the shape of the National Assembly, particularly the leadership of those of the upper and lower house, the Senate and the House of Rep, has been an issue of fierce discussion among politicians and the general populace.
The president-elect, upon his arrival, said people should ignore those who are speculating about his health and that he is strong. There are also reports that they have officially moved into a residence that any incoming president and vice president moves in.
Yes. That was the key point in his speech to his supporters. Apart from asking them to allow him to rest, take a meal and then sleep, and that work starts the following day, he also noted and enjoined the supporters and, of course, the Nigerians at large, you know, because it was widely publicized that they should ignore the rumor mill, because several persons have been alleged, particularly from the opposition, have been alleging that. And that is not surprising because virtually throughout the period he was abroad, there was very little publicity of his activities. You know, when there is a vacuum, we expect that the rumor mill will be afoot. And so he reacted to that statement by saying that they should ignore the rumor mill. But from what we have seen, he has been very energetic. He was waving at supporters, moving about, making speeches at his private residence. And then, of course, he moved to the Defense House. Defense House is the official residence of the president-elect and the vice president-elect, maybe for protection, one, and for the reception of daily briefing, national security information. He's now being briefed on goings on regarding national security, being the president-elect.
What are the expectations of Nigerians regarding the transitional team compiled by the president-elect? People are saying that a segment of the population, the Igbo extraction, were ignored or were not included in the transitional team that he established. And people are concerned that this could create future tension.
The transition team is made up of top government officials of the current administration and his nominees, 11, I think 11 of his nominees. Among the nominees of the president-elect, there's nobody from the Igbo-speaking populace included. Some of his aides have explained that it is his close aides, those who worked in closely in different aspects of his manifesto and campaign, that were nominated for that role. So that is how they have tried to rationalize the exclusion. But one thing is certain, the constitution has what we call the federal character principle enshrined in Nigeria's constitution, which requires that when it comes to forming of the cabinet, at least one minister must come from every state of the country. And there are five states in Nigeria in the southeast geopolitical zones. And the southeast is where you have the majority of the Igbo-speaking population. So it's certain that you're going to have at least a minister from every state, which means that it's impossible for the president-elect upon assumption of office to not have people from the southeast, where the Igbos are generally from, in his cabinet. Because the constitution is a constitutional requirement that the cabinet is from a nominee from every state of the federation. That's a character principle in our constitution. So I think it's a settled matter that it necessarily has to be representative of the entire populace, at least in 3 states of Nigeria.
Ibrahim Momo is a political analyst. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. At the recent World Bank Spring meeting in Washington, Godwin Obaseki, the governor of Nigeria's Edo State, shared his administration's success story of improved public education using public resources of the state's Basic Education Sector Transformation Program. Governor Obaseki says his government deployed heavy public resources in the effort to improve teaching and learning outcomes. The effort also provided insight on how institutional reforms helped to ensure the resources were effectively used to meet set targets for improving foundational literacy and numeracy. The Edo State governor was the only person invited from West Africa to share his administration's success in public education at Washington meetings. I sat down with Governor Godwin Obaseki for an interview about what his administration is currently doing to improve and maintain public education. The governor, who was just re-elected, says Edo State has become an important source on how Nigeria and West Africa can transform and improve public schools. Here is part one of the conversation.
We have a privilege of joining other global leaders, ministers of finance and ministers of education, to sit at a table convened by the World Bank to talk about how to finance education on scale, mm-hmm. particularly since post-COVID. For us in Edo State, in Nigeria, we just have come to realize that education is the key catalyst to the transformation that Africa requires and Africa needs. Mm-hmm. And that part of, one of the key challenges that has held us back is our failure to impact quality learning, quality education on the mass of our people. So it's not enough to have a few good schools here and there and a few individuals who have the opportunity and privilege to come to America. It's how do we ensure that the 10 million children that are out of school are in school, and not just being in school, but they are learning while they're in school. So that was the key motivation for us in Edo.
What were the key findings that you latched on to transform the education, for which you have been invited by the World Bank to talk about it?
I think key was first, how do you scale learning? How do you ensure that, you know, children who are in school at a primary school level are able to receive quality learning from from the school system? Mm-hmm. Key to quality learning are the teachers. Mm-hmm. So the first thing we did was, you know, engage with the teachers, and not just engaging politically, engaging with them technically to try and understand how to help them teach these children better. And we found, you know, and technology, we found out that technology was the key. Mm-hmm. And so we partnered with a private sector firm, mm-hmm. Worked with the technology available to now retrain the teachers, give them handheld devices, which helped them do the things they're supposed to do in class, mm-hmm. and also govern their classrooms better.
Right.
First was, you know, what does a teacher do at the middle school level? First, he wants to ensure attendance. Mm. Secondly, you want to prepare your lesson notes. So all of these have been standardized and put on that device. It also helps me track attendance of the teachers in school, because if a teacher is not in class, the children wouldn't learn. Mm. This feat within the last 4 or 5 years.
Was there a measure to boost the remuneration of teachers or to encourage them? What did you do to encourage them to give of their best, so to speak?
I think the first thing we did was to make sure that their welfare was being taken care of. As a governor, we ensure that people, teachers, workers in the state receive their salary on time monthly. So, yes, we didn't increase their pay spectacularly, but just made sure that they got their pay regularly and on time. There was no fuss. It was almost voluntary. Mm. When we wanted to start the Edo Best program, we had run a pilot, and we made sure that pilot was, the people who participated in the pilot were volunteer teachers. Mm. There was no compulsion to see the benefit. And once they saw the benefit, they sold the benefit to the rest of the teachers. Mm. So it was, and then those who went through that initial training, the first 2,000 of them, because now we've trained almost 16,000 of these teachers, the first 2,000 of them saw the benefit, and they were so proud of what they had accomplished. And I recall one of the teachers who went through the early training coming out and say, you know what? Don't call me a teacher, just call me a digital teacher.
Oh, wow. So let me ask you this. With the successes that have been reported in Edo State, can this be replicated in other states in Nigeria? Because as you know, there is a huge challenge of children not going to school. The federal government has expressed concern about it. Civil society groups have. So can this be replicated across Nigeria?
Certainly can be replicated. In fact, what we've seen since we implemented Edo Best, the Rwandan government has come to understand what we've done, and they are now implementing.
In Rwanda?
In Rwanda.
Okay.
I think one or two other African countries are looking at what we've done, and, you know, we keep doing exchanging notes and having peer learnings. In Nigeria, we've had some states express, you know, the interest and desire, particularly Lagos. Mm-hmm. I got a call from another colleague of mine a couple of weeks ago, who is going to come in the next few weeks with his team to see what we're doing. So yes, for those states that are interested in such quantum leap and such radical transformation of their school systems, we're sharing, you know, ideas.
Godwin Obaseki is Nigeria's Edo State governor. He spoke with me from here in Washington. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation. Zambia's main opposition group, the Patriotic Front, or PFCS, threats to deregister the party is an assault on the country's democracy. The party maintains that it has so far met the requirement of the law that ensures its registration as a political group. The remarks come after the Register of Societies issued a letter to the PF warning that it risked being deregistered for failing to present a list of its officials. Thandiwe Mende, the chief registrar, has given the opposition party 7 days to comply with requirement or risk being disbanded. In response, the PF says the warning is politically motivated, an accusation the Register of Societies sharply denies. For more reaction to the warning to comply with the law, I reach Raphael Nakachinda. He is a member of the PF Central Committee for Information and Publicity.
First of all, it is total recklessness and embarrassing for the Register of Society to write a letter threatening the political party to be deregistered on the basis of just some administrative matters which could have just been resolved through a discussion. We are aware that the UPND have been trying everything to try and disenfranchise Patriotic Front. They have tried to harass senior leaders of Patriotic Front. They have tried to intimidate, to arrest, and all manner of activities against Patriotic Front, all in the hope that the party will disintegrate. But as it were, we have remained resolute and strong and focused. And I think they have seen that we are even more organized this time around as we march towards 2026.
The UPND is calling on your party to just obey the law and stop dragging civil servants into this case, and that the Register of Societies is on firm ground to demand that the PF obeys the law as stipulated in the Constitution, and that, you know, failing to meet the requirement of the law comes with consequences, and that this is not political, but it is the doing of the PF by failing to meet the requirement of the law. How do you respond to that?
This is not the first time we have had such dramatic moves made which are a direct assault to our democracy. The grounds and issues you are raising that we should comply with are basically administrative issues. We have been compliant from the time this party was registered up to now, and there are facts and proof to that, that PF has been submitting the necessary documentation required for us to remain in good standing before the Register of Society. Even the annual returns that we submitted, they received them and approved them, even when there were three officials whose fingerprints were not lifted, meaning that we're in order, save for the fact that at a later stage, those fingerprints were required to be submitted. How does that Register of Society now U-turn and suggest that we have not complied when, in fact, they approved our initial submissions and the explanation that was given?
Initially stated that it's just an administrative oversight that caused this. So this is the doing of the PF, your critics are saying. How do you respond to that?
No, it's not the doing of the PF. If I come to you, Mr. Peter, and I say I'm required to submit this and this to your radio station, and therefore I'm submitting this because the other officials or what documents we had already submitted earlier, and therefore they are still valid, and you accept, then because of political pressure, the registrar is told, no, they should have submitted fresh fingerprints, therefore write a letter to threaten cancellation. And if they don't comply within 7 days, knowing that within the period she has stipulated, 4 days out of the 7 days are a holiday, so that maybe, according to them, possibly we can fail to meet the obligation, then they declare PF deregistered. But the facts are with the lady. And, you know, we live in the same environment. And when you inquire, including the registrar herself, you know, from some quarters we are hearing, she's complaining that I've been under a lot of pressure from these people.
So, quick question. As we speak today, has PF met all the requirements as stipulated by law in Zambia?
As we speak to you today, we have met all the requirements. We have even gone over and above what the registrar requires. The registrar requires only to have 10, a minimum of 10 office bearers for the political party to be said to be in good standing. But we have even gone to an extent of giving them 20 so that they can deal with that.
Rafael Nakachinda is a member of Zambia's main opposition PF Central Committee for Information and Publicity. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. In Uganda, female parliamentarians from the main opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP, are calling on the international community to pressure the administration in Kampala to stop using what they say is violence against women. The lawmakers accused the police of using force following their recent arrest and subsequent release. This after they plan to petition the Internal Affairs Minister over their concerns about violence against women. The lawmakers say state security institutions, including the police, often use excessive force to prevent the lawful activities of female opposition lawmakers in their constituencies. Their complaints were backed by civil society groups who have since condemned the behavior of the police. For more about the call to stop security agencies from using excessive force against female lawmakers, I reached Joyce Bagala. She is the leader of the NUP parliamentarians who led the protest.
We petitioned the Speaker of Parliament about the issues that were happening, especially the harassing of women, female MPs, especially on the opposition. It started with the celebrations of the International Women's Day, where we arranged celebrations in our district, and it started with me. They tear gassed me and sprayed me with paper, and a number of my people were arrested. It happened in Hoima district, happened in Chiboga district, it happened in Kasese, it happened in Mora, and it happened in Soroti city. Now, the worst was in Bovuma, which is in the island, and we said we cannot keep quiet. We can't keep quiet when the rights of women are being violated, and that's why we petitioned the Speaker of Parliament and also indicated to her that we would demonstrate to show our dissatisfaction.
Did you notify the Ugandan police of your plans to...
Oh, we did. We wrote to the IGP.
Because some people are saying you did it.
Yes, we did. We wrote to the Inspector General of Police indicating that we would hold a demonstration and this is what the law requires us to do. So we did that.
Did the police tell you the reason why you were arrested?
They didn't tell us why we were arrested. They simply pounced on us, beat us, humiliated us, almost undressed some members, beat many members. There are some who were injured, and they bundled us into a police van. They drove us to Central Police Station in Kampala. And while there, before we actually got out of the van, they sprayed the van with paper and tear gas while we were still inside.
Did they tell you when they would prefer charges against you? Are there any charges as a result of the arrest?
No, they didn't tell us. In fact, we were released unconditionally.
After your release, what happens next?
That will not stop only at Parliament. The Speaker said the matter is going to come up on Wednesday. But also, we need to petition other stakeholders, including development partners, because the International Women's Day is celebrated not only in Uganda, but also other countries under the United Nations. And we need to tell them that in Uganda, the women leaders who are on the opposition are not allowed to celebrate this day. So there is no reason for Uganda to continue celebrating International Women's Day when the rights of women are violated.
Some people are suggesting that women have made significant strides in Uganda. You have a woman vice president, you have a woman speaker of parliament, yourself, you are in parliament, and high public institutions have had women contributing significantly. So this, they said, suggests that the government embraces the value of the Ugandan woman. And as such, there has to be a synergy
for both parties or both political divide to work together to better the lives of women. What do you say to that?
Certainly, that would be the ideal situation to work together, which the NRM regime is not allowing. But also, I can take you back, Peter, to what you said about a woman Speaker of Parliament, a woman Vice President, a woman Prime Minister, women, I don't know what. Yes, those positions are there. Do they have the influence? Do they influence the direction of the country? Are they the ones in charge? Do they have the power to make things happen? You need to ask yourself, if they did, why is it that all of these women that I've mentioned in many districts, you've never had the voice of a prime minister saying anything? You've never had the voice of a vice president saying anything? Why? If women had that power, if they could make decisions, they would make the decision to not dehumanize another woman, to not humiliate another woman leader, to not harass another woman, but they don't even have a say. They are quiet.
Now, Honorable Pagala, if you said you will not relent, are you not going to put your fellow parliamentarians in danger?
You see, this is what happens. If we want something good to come out of the strife that you're talking about, we've got to work towards it. And there's no one who is forced. If you feel humiliated, if you feel dissatisfied, then you can join the efforts to make things right, to make Uganda better. And you know, women are the mothers of this country. We are the mothers, we are the sisters, we are the wives. We take care of every issue that concerns society. And if women are not well, if they're not treated well, we cannot have a good society. So it is just about everyone who feels dissatisfied.
Joyce Bagala is a Ugandan parliamentarian from the main opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP. She spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the Kenyan commander of the East Africa Regional Force mission in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo has resigned, citing threats to his security. For VOA, Victoria Amunga reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
In his resignation letter dated April 27, the commander of the East Africa Regional Force mission, General Jeff Nyaga, said he was exiting the mission because of what he termed as an aggravated threat to his safety and a systematic plan to frustrate efforts of the force. According to Nyaga, in early January, he was forced to relocate after what he believed to have been monitoring devices placed by mercenaries along with surveillance drones and other methods of physical surveillance at his residence. He also cited, among other items, the suspension of the mission's Facebook page by the DRC government and failure by the same government to pay administrative costs, salaries and electricity bills at the EAC force headquarters. In September 2022, the DRC signed a troop deployment deal with the East African Community to help combat insecurity in the eastern DRC. The mission comprises soldiers from East African member states, including Kenya, Uganda, and South Sudan. Nyaga was appointed commander of the force in September last year, and Kenya approved the deployment of 1,000 soldiers for the new DRC force. The force was created in hopes of curbing violence in eastern Congo, where the government is fighting M23 rebels and clashes have displaced hundreds of thousands of civilians. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Has social media improved your life, or is it more of a distraction? We'd love to hear from you. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code plus 1, then 202-258-3076. The number again, plus 1, 202-258-3076. Can't wait to hear from you.
As some fighting continues in Sudan, despite rival forces agreeing to extend a truce, the United States says it desires to see a durable cessation of hostilities and a free flow of humanitarian access in the Northeast African country. Details from VOA Chief's national correspondent Steve Herman in Washington.
State Department spokesman Vedant Patel told reporters Friday the United States is continuing discussions with the rival generals heading the Sudanese army and the country's rapid security forces to try to get them to extend the ceasefire and to realize the dire impact the violence is having.
Reduction in violence will allow and continue to allow for the conditions to persist that are allowing operations to take place that are getting American citizens to safety, that are getting our allies and partners to safety, and the personnel and citizens of our allies and partners to safety as well.
2 weeks of warfare in Sudan have left hundreds of people dead, thousands wounded, and prompted numerous countries to carry out risky evacuation operations of civilians, aid workers, and diplomats. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
Amid hopes that a shaky ceasefire in Sudan will hold, people continue to flee the capital, Khartoum, many by public bus. The road to Port Sudan has been one of the safer routes, but still has risks, including checkpoints along the way. For VOA, Michael Atit joined the journey and has this report on the road to Port Sudan.
After more than 2 weeks of fighting between the Sudanese military and the paramilitary rapid support forces, civilians in Khartoum have little choice but to run for their lives. Some 70 people, a mix of foreign nationals, including women and children, took the risky road Thursday from Khartoum to Port Sudan on the Red Sea, a journey that takes more than 10 hours by bus. As our bus made progress, passengers could see the destruction in neighborhoods. Rapid support forces fighters could be seen at many intersections, but they didn't attempt to stop the bus nor ask where it was going. After 25 minutes, the bus arrived at the first military checkpoint, where some individuals were asked to disembark with their identity cards, including me. The process went smoothly and in a friendly manner, as I showed them my South Sudanese passport. Not far from the military checkpoint, the bus also passed an RSF checkpoint, where the personnel were also friendly to everyone. Shortly after leaving Shendi Town in River Nile State, two bus tires got punctured. The people were nervous and terrified by the sound. Women had to remain on the bus, but men had to come down to help replace the tire. Unfortunately, the driver had only one spare tire. The bus had to wait on a desert road for an hour until a good Samaritan came by to give the second tire. One of the bus passengers was Muhammad Azam, a Syrian national who has been working in Sudan as a medical doctor.
Whenever they will see that we are foreigners and we are trying to flee for our lives, they will reassure us and tell us that the road will be safe. And actually it was, the road was safe till Port Sudan.
Azam says he is leaving Sudan with mixed feelings because he didn't plan to leave the country at this time.
I have the feeling of joy and a little bit of sadness, you know. It's like a home for me over here. I'm here since 2018. Yeah. Right now I'm going to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Over there, there is part of my family there. It's a happy moment for me, so because I'm going to meet them, inshallah.
A Tanzanian national who identified himself only as Hussein says this was his first time seeing such a heavy fighting. Speaking to VOA after his safe arrival to Port Sudan Thursday night, Hussein says Khartoum is no longer a safe place.
It's the first time to see the big battle like this one, yeah? As before, we used to see the small one, but never affected us. But like this one, it's really different because many people have been killed.
At the southern port in Port Sudan, foreign nationals are being screened before they board a ship to Saudi Arabia. From there, they are expected to leave for their respective home countries. Michael Atit for VOA News, Port Sudan.
If you are in Sudan witnessing events taking place there, or if you have family you are talking to there, you can call us on WhatsApp and let us know how things are going there. Dial the international code plus one, then 202-258-3076. The number again, the international code plus one, then 202-258-3076.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Hey, it's DJ Stavo, and you tuned into Nightline Africa on Voice of America. And you've just heard my brand new single titled Mtandazo. I hope you enjoyed.
My name is Divine Tembeng Mba from Pretoria in South Africa, and you are listening to Nightline Africa from the Voice of America with Peter Clothi. Stay tuned and don't change that dial.
For one off, can you decide if you're in or not? Oh no, oh no, oh no. Go to the chase, mamacita. Come have a taste, senorita. They could just ride with you on me and smoke up till the morning. There she goes, make me lose control. She run wild, shocker, shocker. Close my game, call up, big go. Nobody knows. Let's keep it on a low. Don't mind them, shabale, shasha. If you need me, call on me, coco.
Friends about VOA Africa, music, sports, and news.
Yanikolo big manimo beach and is no gisha. Inocolo beef, my sickolo be manicolo nisha. Yanikolo big, nakolo shisha, nikolo nisha.
Quaqualata, quaqualata.
Yanikolo big manimo beach and is no gisha. Inocolo beef, my sickolo.
I enter from Abuja, go Kwakwalata. Only mother can suffice ya water. I know fit for some if it don't pass my power. I roll up a shower, my body for Kwakwalata. I enter from Abuja, go Kwakwalata. Only mother can suffice ya water.
Oh God, you let me ask God. I be flaming, with your mashami, I'm in the reaction. Wahabi, I look, look at how move at you. And you see, with your mari be your commander. Love this song, tomorrow shot. Love me, you ease and I cry. Baby, don't you waste my time. I see my boots up. I know fit for
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Mike Hovey, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a slave boy is blamed no matter what he does. If he does not wash his hands, he is accused of being dirty. If he washes his hands, he is accused of wasting water. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C., give me